that very wonderful poem or gatha that Betsy just read is a wonderful invitation. And it's quite simple. If you're just here, sitting, with no thought of yourself, no thought of anybody else, in that moment you have liberated yourself from all the various complexes of self, superiority, inferiority, inequality. If you just do not hold on to a thought of self and other, in that moment you are liberated from that. And if your mind is calm, equanimous, you are generating peace, peacefulness. Your mind is at peace. So it's really a one-step process. Don't make these things into too complex. It's really quite simple. So before we begin with the formal talk today, we always have an opportunity for questions. Obviously, any questions about the practices we've done here this morning. The practices of mindfulness of body breath, the practices of watching the mind and looking at thoughts or looking at the thinker. These are all very fundamental practices within the Buddhist meditation tradition. If you have any questions about how to do them or what they were about, if you had any experiences aren't clear to you or confusing, please feel free to ask a question. As well as in terms of your own understanding and practice of mindfulness, Buddhism, of meditation, and how you bring it into your daily life, your personal life, work life. If there are any questions about any issues or any confusions about how to apply it into all situations of your life, so therefore to produce clarity and openness, spaciousness, well-being. If that is not yet clear to you, please feel free to ask a question. Don't be shy. So any questions right now? Yes.
So if I'm looking at the thought, and I think I'm looking at the thought.
Well, you're not.
You know, about the thought. You know.
So the question is: so you're looking at the thoughts, which was a practice we did. You're just looking right at the thought. You're looking.
Right.
Right. The same way you're looking at me. Right. You just look at me. That's looking. Right. So in the same way, when you turn into your mind, right, there's phenomena. There are thoughts, feelings, perceptions, images, memories, right? There's all kinds of mental phenomena, right? And the same way, we just stop and we look at them. Rather than, usually we are unconscious followers, right? We are the monkey in the zoo, always looking around. Anything that's going on, it's looking. We are like the distracted little five-year-old, right? Just anything that's going on, it turns its head and looks at. But in this practice, we are giving up our childish ways. And we, when there is a thought, we just look at it. We don't react to it. We don't grab onto it. We just look at it. And when you look at it, it will disappear. Thoughts cannot stand up to scrutiny. So that was not your experience.
Well, for me, the scrutiny was having a thought about the thought.
Well, then look right at that one. Right? So you just, this is the practice, you just keep looking at them until they begin to break up or until you begin to get it. Because when you watch thoughts and you watch them as they really are, which is what? Empty of any permanence, any substance, they just disappear, they come and go. You know, after that, you know, it's sort of like if you're somebody who's, you know, you just like to sit and watch people, you know. After, and you're watching them, you know, always watching this. You know, after a while, you may realize you're kind of putting a strain on your neck. And you may decide, you know, and after you've watched 100 or 200 people go by, you may find them less interesting. And so you might be willing just to kind of rest your poor head. Have it relax. And just say, just relax. You don't have to follow everything that happens. You can just be very relaxed and let things just pass. So there is a learning, there is a wisdom that comes from these practices. It's not simply observing. It's not simple mindfulness. Mindfulness allows you to see what's really going on. When you get what's going on, that's called wisdom. That's called understanding. Mindfulness by itself is not liberating. Mindfulness, when it leads to insight or understanding or wisdom, or intelligence, we might say, can be liberating. Because now you get it. Oh, so what do you get about thoughts? They just come and go, endlessly, nonstop, right? And if we think they're real, solid things, we get very intrigued by them. And we follow them, and we believe them, right? Right? You have a thought that says, really, I'm doing a great job today. You feel what? Good. You have another thought, gee, I'm doing a terrible job today. You feel what? Bad. But what if the whole thing is a scam? You see? What if the whole show is a scam? Right? That's very different, isn't it? And the way you begin to get that is you use your mindfulness to observe reality. In this case, observe thoughts. Right? Because when you're lost in them, when you're lost in your stories about yourself or life, they seem very what? Real. Very important. Right? Very true. Right? And we have, therefore, a lot of emotion around them, too, because of that. But when you do this practice where you learn to observe, to watch, to really see what's going on, you'll see something very different. This is something that's readily available to everybody here to see. But you have to learn how to stop and to watch and to observe and to draw conclusions from your own observation. Does that?
Yes, and I guess the other part is for me distinguishing, I just find it easier to just let go of the thought. By watching it, then my mind seems to want to stay more engaged. So that's why I was trying to understand, I guess, if, you know, there's more value to sort of doing the really intense looking as opposed to letting go.
So the question is, her practice is usually to try to let go of the thoughts. And she finds that often when she tries to watch them, she tends to get more involved. You got it. That's the problem. Right. The problem with a practice where you simply are always letting go is what? There's no end to it. You're endlessly holding on and letting go. Have you noticed that? It's an endless practice. It's better than not letting go and holding on for dear life. So we might say, getting on the bucking bronco and realizing you're on the bucking bronco and getting off is probably better than staying on. Right? But how about not getting on at all? Wouldn't that be better? Right? So the horse comes running by, galloping by, you grab onto it, it takes you for a little bit ride, and finally you go, I better let go, and you let go. Right? Fall down in the dirt, pick yourself up, start again. 5 minutes later, the next horse comes by. Grab onto the, you know, it's, right? It's like that. How about not getting on at all? You learn not to get on at all when you learn to watch them, see them for what they are, and not get on. So what you're saying is it's hard for you now because you find that when you are engaged in thinking, your habitual energy is to grab on. So learning to, learning to watch your mind and learning to just let things unfold in your mind without grabbing on is hard, right? Right? The same way, if you're an addict, right? Learning to be around this stuff and not indulging is hard. Right? Much easier just not to be around this stuff. Right? But over time, if you really have solidity in your sobriety, so to speak, can be around the stuff and you won't indulge. Because you'll know what? What do you know? Toxic. What? It's toxic. It's not good for me. Yeah, you can put it right in front of me, you can offer it to me, but I don't take it because I know it's toxic. You know, and once you know that, it's no longer a struggle, is it? When you still don't know that, then you're always wanting and holding yourself back. That's the process of endlessly letting go. Now, is it better than indulging? Yes. So that practice of always letting go is a good step up, isn't it? But it's only a developmental step in this path. In the same way, if you have been addicted to a substance, right? You know, learning not to take it on, take it in, or when you do, to learn to stop, is good, isn't it? It's definitely a step up. But again, you want to get to the place where your understanding of the nature of the addiction, the nature of the substance, the nature of your relationship to it is all very clear to you, and you no longer indulge. You're no longer, it's not a problem to you anymore. Is that clear? This is very important because the practice of mindfulness is the beginning. It's the foundation, but it's not the end. The end, you know, is liberation. We want liberation, we want freedom. And that only comes from understanding. Good. Yes.
So in the same way that an addict may be addicted to a substance, mm-hmm. I have found in my past, I've been taken away and led askew by emotion.
Mm-hmm.
But am I correct? Or in the understanding that, again, I realize that it's really the thought that triggers an emotion, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So by looking at the thought, it's the same concept. By looking at the thought directly, usually will kind of ease the emotion.
So the question is, is that the same emotions, right? In other words, When the mind is taken over by an emotion, does one do the same thing? And the answer is yes, right? I mean, because again, the emotion is arising in your mind. And you can be, you know, the same way if I said to you, MT, what emotion are you feeling? You would say what? I'm feeling, I mean, name me an emotion that takes you away. It would be what?
Irritation.
I'm feeling anger, all right? I'm feeling angry, okay? Now, to say that, that means you, there is an awareness that something is occurring within your body, mind, called, you're naming it anger, and you know it's present in your mind. Your mind is aware that there's anger within it, we could say, right? And in the same way, if you learn not to go with it, not to feed it, right? But just to watch it, emotions have the same characteristic as thoughts, which is what? They're not solid. They're not permanent. They also just arise and dissipate. You know, that is the nature of mental phenomena. Right? Notice how long do your thoughts last? Try to hold a thought. How long can you hold a thought? You have to repeat it, right? Thoughts don't last. I mean, it's kind of simple, right? It has to be kept repeated. Thoughts, you know, are impermanent. They're impermanent because they have no substance. Right? In the same way, emotions. I mean, does anybody here have an emotion that they've had for 20 years nonstop? Always. Anybody have an emotion like that? Right? Why is that? Because the nature of emotions are what? They're not solid. They're not permanent. They're just the mind stuff that come and go. Now, what MT is talking about is one of the things she's discovered is a lot of their reason they stay around a lot or even arise is because of our thoughts, the stories we tell ourselves. Right? And the more we repeat the story, the more we think about the incident, the more we regurgitate, the more we just replay it over and over again in our visualization and our mind, the emotion will stay. But the truth is, it is staying because of the repetition. Emotions of them, by and of themselves, are the same nature of thoughts. They're empty of any solidity or permanence. So again, just learning that, and learning to just let them go, come and go, is a way to be free. Is that clear? Good. Other questions? Yes.
I had a strange experience. My daughter went to the hospital the night before last because she had pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost a son 20 years ago.
Yes.
So the first part of the mind, my mind, well, mostly I was fine about it. I mean, mostly I didn't tell myself a story. Mostly I was just being with it. I didn't have results yet, you know, and each day became alive. But part of my mind would come up with, I couldn't bear the misery.
Yes.
And then, but I would see that, and I would say to myself, you don't know anything yet, and this is nothing like that. And then it would go, and most of the time I was fine with it. But then the thought would come in, something's wrong with you, you're not worrying. I should be worrying, this is really serious, you should be in the hospital. Should I fly there? Of course, you know, maybe I should go. And then I would stop, and I would be okay with it for a long time. So the part of me that thought there was something wrong with me, I'm not a good mother, I'm not worrying, was mostly not there, but it did come up.
Yeah. So I'm just repeating this for the recording. So the question or the sharing was daughter's grown daughter is sick in the hospital with pneumonia. Ruth lost a son 20 years ago who died. So Ruth said there's a part of her that's kind of stable and grounded and understanding about this process with her daughter, but then there's a voice that sort of wants to put it in the context of the son who died and create some drama there. But she's handling it pretty good. And then another voice from the other side goes, "What's wrong with you?" You know, there should be drama here. You should be worried. You should be, yeah, and that's good. That's good. I want to say something about the first thought, which was in relationship to your daughter in the hospital, the recollection of your son who died, and the thought, if she died, I couldn't bear it. The truth is, you know that you can bear it, because you have borne it, right? That's the truth. So we have to be very careful that our thoughts are congruent with reality. The truth is what? We can bear anything. That is the truth. The human mind has that capacity. And we know that in this life, many people in the world bear all kinds of things, don't they? Their whole family's dying. Bears, you know what I mean? So we know that the thought, I couldn't bear this, is simply a thought. It is not true. Right? Because with your understanding, right, you know better. It's not to say that the loss of a child wouldn't be incredibly painful, you know what I'm saying? It's not. But we have to watch the extremities that our distorted thinking will take us. The truth is, you could bear this. You don't want to bear it, but if it happened, you could bear it. That's, to me, that is a much better kind of way to operate in life. Now, I think your other thought, which was, as you noticed that in this family drama, that you were not that freaked out. And there's a part of you that goes, hey, what kind of mother are you? Right? You should be worried. You should be jumping on a plane. You should be jumping right in and, right? Yeah. And I think that's an interesting, I've heard that before, right? There are many people that think if you love somebody, you need to be always worried about them. If you love someone or care about, you always have to be thinking about them. As if somehow relationship is just some activity that goes on in our mind and not in reality. Right? You know, that we have to maintain the drama of relationship. And oftentimes the drama, the connection is through anxiety. Same way some people maintain relationships for many years based on resentment or anger. You know, as if somehow, you know, that's the glue that keeps the relationship alive. But again, that also is not very healthy, is it? I think those of us who have always lived a life of drama and have always lived in our relationships with lots of drama, right? Ups and downs and anger, resentments, you know, fears and worries and, right, and losses and guilt, you know what I mean, all that, you know what I'm talking about? Everybody clear what that's about? Right. So those people who have always lived in that kind of life and think that's normal, right, when all of a sudden, because one is beginning to develop some clarity or calmness of mind and some deeper understanding about life, that all of a sudden that high-level melodrama begins to diminish, there's a part you can go, you know, it's like something's missing, right? And, you know, like where's the drama? Right? Where's the melodrama? Where's the emotionality? And our goal is not to become numb, right? But it's also to have an emotional life that is congruent with reality and healthy. And so I think as often, if one has always lived in high degrees of emotionality and ups and downs and lots of melodrama, one may find if one gets into a practice like this, one might find that in relationship to how things were, things are a little more boring, right? Things are a little boring, you know, than where they used to be. I mean, you know, I refer to addicts because I think, in a certain sense, the extremity of addiction is only the extremity of the way most people conduct themselves. It's just a little more apparent. But a lot of addicts say that, right? You know, I mean, right? When they stop drinking and drugging, it's like life is kind of dull. And they're absolutely right compared to that way of living. It is quite dull. But the reason they've stopped using is because they realized that level of activity and stimulation was fundamentally toxic, unhealthy, poisonous to them, right? So in the same way, when we sort of come out of the drama of self, the melodrama of self, things are calmer, more peaceful. Have you noticed, if you've ever been around people who've been meditating for many years, or teachers, masters, right? What do you notice about them? They're peaceful. There's not a lot of drama. They're calm. Right, they're calm even when there's lots of activity going on. So we should take these people as our mentors, as our examples of what it means to be a human being. Melodrama is interesting in the movies. It's interesting in soap operas, right? But I think for one's own personal life, probably not, right? Because don't forget, even those movies and melodramas only last a couple of hours, right? I mean, would you want to watch some soap opera 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? After a while, it would get a little, old? Probably get a little sick of it. Other questions about practice and daily life? Yes. What is your name again?
Julia.
Yes, Julia.
What if, for me, the hardest part of meditation is not the thing of physical pain. I'm going to my legs. They can kill me. So how can I?
Okay, so Julia's question is, the biggest kind of distraction or difficulty she has is physical pain when you're sitting. And the physical pain is where?
Right here on your hip.
In your hip. So again, first of all, please make sure that you're taking a posture that is not so painful. All right, so how do you sit? Just like that, with your legs crossed. So again, You know, sometimes, like Diane here is also very helpful to people in posture. So sometimes to kind of get a little consultation about, because there's a relationship between the posture you're taking, and you'll notice there are different kind of cushions around. Some are thicker, and so sometimes just kind of the kind of a structure of how you're sitting can be alleviated somewhat. Okay, so I would say get a consultation. How long have you been meditating sitting cross-legged?
Not too long.
So again, also the other problem, Julia, is we're not used to sitting this way, and there is, you know, I mean, if you're committed that you want to learn, and you're in it for the kind of long haul, that there is a process whereby you know, your legs will adjust and your muscles will adjust and tendons and all that, and obviously doing stretching and things like yoga and different things can be helpful in that, but also choosing the posture, you know, a posture that's comfortable for you. Now, having said all that, would you really describe the pain as excruciating? I just want you to step back and be objective, or is it just uncomfortable?
Well, I'm good. Like, the first 10 minutes, I'm good, and, you know, I can quiet my mind about thoughts. That's not an issue. But then the only thing that comes and goes is, like, oh, your back is hurting.
Okay, so you have, okay. But if I said to you, when the round is over, and when you get up and move around, do you still have excruciating pain? Okay. When you go home at the end of meditation, is it something that is caused, you know?
No, I do yoga like 2 or 3 hours a day.
Oh, wow.
I do it every day. So it's not that my body is not comfortable, it's just this
one part of you. Okay. So, but again, the important thing is, you are not, because you're saying that when you get up everything is fine and whatever, and you're basically, then you know that, again, you know, we don't want to do harm to our body. So what you're saying is, it is uncomfortable in the posture, but it doesn't, like, it stays with you the rest of the day, or you're doing harm, because we don't want to, again, so. Again, like I said earlier, you might have somebody work with you on your posture because there may be things to do. But on the other side, even though it is uncomfortable for you, what you're telling me is you're not doing extreme harm to yourself. Okay. Knowing that, Julia, you're in an interesting place, right? Your body is giving you distress signals. It's uncomfortable. But the truth is, you're saying in your reality-based mind, it's not like you're doing injury to it, right? And it's not unbearable, is it? Okay. Well, I'm asking you to step outside and be objective. This is not unbearable pain.
Yeah, but I want to get out.
Yes. So this is a choice point for you, Julia, right? Because again, you don't have to, you can just get out of it, couldn't you? All right. But you could also do something else, which could be interesting if you want to experiment a little. Having established that you're not doing damage to your body, and knowing that the round will end, what you're talking about is going through a period of uncomfortableness in your body. And what we know about ourselves is, many of us, we don't like being uncomfortable, do we? Mm-mm-mm. We like being what? Comfortable. And that uncomfortableness that we don't like is not just only physically. We don't like uncomfortable emotions. We don't like uncomfortable situations, right? And usually when we're in these kinds of situations, we want to find a quick way to end it, don't we? The problem with that is what? There's no freedom in that. Because when you are in something that you perceive as uncomfortable or unpleasant, your immediate response is, I got to end this, I got to stop this, I got to get away from this. Right? So in that case, it is the experience which is in control. Right? And you're just reacting to it. So there is another way. Are you up for this? Okay. Now, you're noticing a couple of things, right? You're noticing that when you have that unpleasant sensation in your this area, your kind of thighs or buttocks or a little bit in your lower back, right? Immediately there are thoughts, right? And the thoughts are telling you what? What? Because right. We got to stop this. We don't like this, right? There's a part of you that's going, stop it, right? We don't like. But yet you're telling me that it's not injurious, right? And your body is quite capable of tolerating it, isn't it? And very quickly recuperating afterwards. So if I said to you, Julia, what this voice that says, I don't like this, uncross the legs immediately. I mean, is it your legs that are saying that to you? Is it your legs that are saying that? No. You'd think if there was some part of you that was kind of giving you the order, it would be your legs, wouldn't it? But your legs aren't saying, uncross me. Right? Okay. So what is that that's on someone that's giving you the orders that says it's so, I don't like this, I don't want to experience this, you know, uncross your legs immediately. What is that? What is that voice and where is it coming from? You see, it's interesting. Because if it wasn't that voice, wherever it's coming from and whoever it is, you would be just experiencing uncomfortability in your body, right? In Buddhist psychology, we call those sensations, right? Simply sensations. Now, what if instead of having this negative response to those uncomfortable sensations, you had a neutral response, and you actually accepted what was happening, and actually relaxed in there. Because what we often find is when we're in an uncomfortable pain or so-called painful situation, we tense, we constrict, and that is both emotional as well as physical. So instead of constricting and tightening, which does what to the uncomfortableness? Only makes it more intense. So what if instead of, again, reacting so negatively in a voice, you didn't pay that any mind and you didn't follow it. It's just barking orders at you. Uncross your legs immediately. I can't take this anymore. But who is this? It's the knees that are having the problem or the legs that are having the problem. Who is this that is so upset about this and says they can't take it anymore? It's, again, interesting to look for. But in the short run, just to relax, right? And just become a little more spacious.
Would you move in the middle of like your stillness?
Well, again, there's no right or wrong here. I mean, is there any law against moving? No. Right? Again, you know, I think in this simple posture and in this simple practice, much can be learned. Right, Julia? In other words, we're not doing this so you can master a technique. You're doing this so you could learn about Julia. You see? That's really the most important thing. And what we find in meditation is all our stuff joins us on the mat. You understand what I'm saying to you? And so when you understand that it's not simply learning to, you know, concentrate, but it's also you're trying to really understand Julia. and the way she deals with things. You see, and so, you know, you have a physical sensation and you see, how does Julia deal with it? I want to get out of this immediately, right? That's the voice. And that's interesting, isn't it? And I would imagine you, this is not the only place you hear that voice, right? So again, it's whether you want to kind of use meditative practice as a way also of deepening your understanding of Julia. And finding, you know, new ways of dealing with things. Does that make sense? So in that case, you know, in the bigger picture, whether you move your legs or not, it doesn't matter, does it? Right? I mean, you can maintain your concentration. I mean, moving your legs shouldn't be a deal breaker. Right? So that's not the issue. The issue is, oh, this is interesting. You know, do I want to learn to work with bodily discomfort in a different way than I've always done? Is there something for me to really gain here? And if I learn about it in this way, may I learn about it, how I apply it in other situations or whatever where I'm uncomfortable? Is there another way? Is that clear? So again, it really has to do with you and how you want to practice, what the practice is about for you. Is that clear? Good. Other questions about practice? Yes.
Chase, referring to the unexpected or uncomfortable situation.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you put up with it?
Now, we're talking about the physical pain, or you're talking about other types of situations?
Physical.
Again, so the question is, well, if you are dealing with physical pain when you're sitting, how long do you put up? Again, I'm putting in the caveat that you're not doing injury to your body, okay? You know, as long as this is not doing injury to your body, but is just an uncomfortable situation that comes because our bodies are not used to sitting still or in certain postures, and after a while there's uncomfortableness, but it's not injurious, then I would say the same thing I said to Julia, which is, you know, Clara, you know, do you want to use that as a practice opportunity? In other words, again, whether you move or don't move, you know, is not that all that big a deal. The question is, you know, at what point in life do we want to stop reacting to every uncomfortable physical, emotional, situational, you know, and do we want to learn how to stay, be present, and be open and spacious, and just, you know, let it unfold. And you hold that situation, whatever it is, in awareness, in mindfulness. And the voice that's telling you, you know, I can't take this anymore, it's just a voice. I mean, who's saying that? I mean, are we, you know, we're always, you know, there is this unknown disembodied voice that's always giving us orders, right? And we listen to it. You know, feel this, get angry about this, worry about this, you know, get hurt about that, right? And we go, okay, all right. It's just a voice. They're just thoughts. And if we're willing to just spend a moment, rather than reacting, just watching and holding and just, we'll see that for ourselves. So again, on the cushion, a lot of learning can take place. Is that clear? Right? You know, like a lot of times people get bored, right? Well, this is boring, right? You know, because we are what? We are used to stimulation. We're used to activity. Well, this is boring. Nothing's going on, right? Where's the remote? You know, I mean, like, I mean, sometimes we'll get bored and people will tell me, you know, they'll just start creating fantasies or going over stories, you know, just to keep the stimulation going. Because why? Because we have not developed the capacity to be happy, content in just being alive and aware. We haven't broken through to that aliveness. Right? There is a natural aliveness of this mind. It is not dependent on stimulation externally or internally. Right? Everybody here, that is your original mind. Everybody had it as a child. You were content. You could just do your little thing and everything was okay. It didn't take much, right? I have a 1-year-old grandson. He's interested in everything. He's just curious. He can just look at a watch and be happy, curious. We all have that capacity to be naturally, spontaneously open. Simplicity. So in our meditation, we may go through periods of, you know, lots of thoughts and, you know, all that stuff that's always going on. And then we'll flip to the other side, which is what? Boring. You know, nothing going on. Right? This is terrible. When's this round going to end? I'm bored. Right? I mean, it shows you how bad a shape we are. You know, we look forward to walking. I mean, like, oh, thank God we're walking. Don't think I could sit for another moment. I'm so bored. Again, Clara, when you sit, Clara is sitting with you. And if you are mindful, if you are watchful, you will learn about her. Okay? Because she'll just do all the stuff she always does in life. But on the cushion, you'll see her more clearly. Right? And you'll see those things that are worth retaining. And you'll see those things that really don't serve her well. Or those aspects that really create suffering or uncomfort. You know what I'm saying? And so, oh. So that's good. We want to learn about her, don't we? Yeah, so that's good. So again, uncomfortableness, pain, boredom, you know, welcome these states because you're learning about yourself. Is that clear? This is very important. Sitting in meditation is like being in a laboratory, except you're the experiment. You're the subject of the experiment. So you have to learn to be very objective about your own stuff. I mean, is this clear? I mean, this practice is about you and your own healing and transformation, your own awakening. It's only going to happen inside you. So you want to learn how to be present to yourself. And many people don't want to be present to themselves. Because why? Maybe they don't like themselves. Well, that's interesting. I mean, how could you not like yourself? I mean, who is it inside you that doesn't like this thing, this other? I mean, how does that work? There's a part of you that thinks he or she is better than the other part of you? Who's that? I mean, there's a part of you that goes, how did I get stuck with that one? A guy like me deserves something better than to be stuck with this one all, you know? It sounds crazy, doesn't it? It is crazy. So, we want to learn how to be present to ourselves in a non-judgmental way, just to observe. That's why, Julia, it's so important that you learn to observe Julia when she's uncomfortable, right? Well, this is interesting. And you kind of just watch her act out, right? She's acting out in there, isn't she? Do you notice that? She's just acting out, creating a big, big drama, right? At moments like this is the end of the world. This is the most painful thing in the world. And if it, you know, can you see her just getting totally wrapped up in it, doesn't she? Yeah. And all it is what? Some uncomfortable sensations in a certain part of her body. Oh, you're learning about her. Can you see? And you're not dismayed or disgusted or frustrated. You go, oh, that's interesting. Huh? I wonder if she does that in other areas of her life. You see, and you go, oh, that's interesting. And you just kind of follow her around and you learn about her. And then you want to help her. Because that, you can see how she takes a situation and creates a lot of suffering for herself. But first you have to see it and feel it. And then you kind of learn from it, right? Clara, can you see? You go, oh, yeah. So she's okay with a certain level of uncomfortableness, but a certain while she goes, no more. That's it. And again, you learn about Clara. Right? Yeah, so it's good. Any other questions about practice, please? Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about developing concentration with mindfulness? Especially on your sitting practice, but also a lot of power.
Yeah. Again, concentration, so the question is mindfulness and concentration, how are they different, how do they work together? Is that right, Evelyn? Okay. See, concentration is an interesting word. Please remember that these words as they were originally used in Sanskrit and Pali and other traditions, they all, when they came to English-speaking country, they had to find words, right, for translation, right? And so concentration is one of those words, I think, which is misused. Okay. In Buddhism, in the meditative tradition, There are traditionally three fundamental aspects of meditation: mindfulness, then what we're calling concentration, and then insight. But the actual words are actually different in meaning. Right? Mindfulness kind of means the capacity to kind of, it's like a kind of a recollecting awareness, right? Kind of one knows where one is. One kind of knows where one wants to be. You see, it's a kind of a general capacity to be present in awareness to a situation, to be mindful. But it really has to do also with the capacity to remember and remember that. And also to recollect what one is doing. So it's a whole, in a certain way, I like the term actually wakefulness. To me, it's a little broader. It means being wakeful, being awake in a situation, right? Just the same way we know that when we're asleep, we don't know what's going on around us, right? But when we wake up, right, when we open our eyes and wake up, we know where we are. Is that clear? So you see how simple that is? When you're asleep, things can be going on. It could be nice out or dark out or light out, or people can be, you know, all kinds of stuff can be going on, but we don't know it because we're asleep. When we're awake, we immediately see what's going on, right? So wakefulness is very important, right? To be awake to one's situation, to alive to what one is seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and feeling, thinking, right? That's all mindfulness, wakefulness. The word concentration is often taken from the word samatha, right? And samatha really means a kind of calming, stabilizing, quieting, integrating the mind. Right? That's what it's about. That's the practice. Right? So it is a mind that is not dispersed. It is a mind that is not distracted. It is a mind that's not jumping around everywhere. It is a mind that is stable. A mind that is calm. Now, a meditative practice that is helpful of that is concentrating the mind on an object, right? So, can you see, in that sense, meditative concentration is a technique within this broader stabilization of the mind, integration of the mind, quieting and calming, grounding the mind. So that's the focus. And again, learning to rest the mind on something and to keep it there with some consistency. Obviously, if you can imagine the energies of the mind going off in a million directions, to kind of bring it more, right? You can see we'll create that kind of focus will tend to quiet and calm and stabilize the mind. So that's concentration. But I don't like the word concentration, even though I use the word concentration. The word samatha means much more than that. So you want to quiet and stabilize the mind. And learning to concentrate it, let's say, on the breath and the body. Now again, please remember that a lot of the meditative manuals that one may access that traditionally in Buddhist countries, most of the people who practiced meditation did it in a much more focused way. They did it on retreats. So many of these meditation manuals were written for people who were, for weeks, for months, for years, living in a solitary way, just meditating day and night. So many of these manuals were written for them and by them. So you often think that you need to attain a state of concentration or focus, which is really nearly impossible for people like us, because why? Because we're not living that kind of life. We're living a very, very busy life, lots of stimulation. So that kind of idea that somehow the kind of deeply single-minded focus that could be reached by people who are in totally unstimulating environments, I would say is nearly impossible, unless you have great natural ability. And I would also say that it's not necessary. Because the focus of practice in our tradition is liberation from suffering. That's what this is about. And to do that, one definitely needs a certain degree of wakefulness and mindfulness. One certainly needs a certain degree of a calm and stable mind. To do the work of, like we were saying, of looking more deeply into reality, into the mind. But that level of perfect concentration and samadhi, from all my teachers, is really unnecessary. That's not, if you're going on a three-year retreat and want to experience all kinds of meditative trances that come about through that kind of focus, that's fine. But Shakyamuni Buddha did that. He mastered the trances. And he rejected that as a path of liberation. Understanding the nature of reality, the empty nature of phenomena, the empty nature of self, that is truly liberating. Is that? Other questions about practice? Think about your practice, your life, anything, not any question you have about how to apply the teachings and the practices to your life. Make sure everything has been cleared up. If anything's not clear, don't hesitate to ask. Yes.
Is not having thoughts, occasionally you may not have a thought, you may just be experiencing something, they're sitting, and then I recognize I wasn't thinking, and then that little voice says to me, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you... Like, you should be thinking of, you should always be, your thoughts are always coming. So when you're not thinking, what is that? Or it's just...
You mean you have a thought about thinking?
As stupid as that may sound, yes.
Hold on. Who said that was stupid?
Me.
Good. I think you're absolutely right. Now, that was wisdom. Right.
Yeah.
There's no end to it. You know, there was a great Japanese master, Bankei. He called what you're talking about, he said, that's trying to clean blood up with more blood. There's a stain of blood, and you take a rag full of blood to clean up the blood stain. And you go, what?
Ridiculous.
So trying to clear up thoughts with more thoughts is the same. Ridiculous. Just thoughts. Right? And this mind is so crazy, it'll comment on its own thoughts. So your question is what? What's really your question? Is there life without thoughts?
I guess it's where are you?
Empty. Let me ask you a question. What is this?
It's a flower.
Okay. Now, before you said the word flower, didn't you have to know what this was?
Identify it.
Right, but before you use the words, it's a flower, those are words, right? That's a label. What knew before you said the words what this was? Something had to know. Right? Because something knew what this was and didn't say giraffe. Right? Something new before the thought arose that this was a flower. Are you with me?
Okay.
No, but are you with me? You get it? Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So something new before the thought arose what this was. Right? Even if you didn't call it a flower. I mean, if I said, no, this is a giraffe, MT. MT looks and she knows what? So, this mind has a capacity of knowing independent of thought.
That's what it is.
Right. But we have so gotten lost in the world of thoughts, we think, that it's only when you put something into thought that it becomes real. Right? I mean, there are lots of people have to turn everything they do into a story, and they either have to tell themselves or call somebody up immediately. Right? You can't believe what just happened to me. Or now we text it instantly. Or we take a picture of it. Right? And put it, because then it becomes real. Because we've lost the capacity to know that just experience, that's what's real. But we've lost touch with our capacity to live in reality, so we live in thought. Right? So you know what this is, don't you? Right? I mean, and then saying it's a flower, I mean, does that make it better? Does that make this better? Look at this. I mean, say beautiful flower. Does that make it better than just? I mean, if you said it was a beautiful flower, there was already a part of you that knew it was a beautiful flower. It was already experiencing that. Am I right? So this mind has the capacity of knowing, which then can be put into thought. But so again, that's why the emphasis is not on thought, the emphasis is on experience. That's why we just let thoughts come and go. Because we want to keep our focus on what? Direct experience of whatever's going on. So when you look at a thought, as opposed to thinking a thought, when you hold the thought with your awareness, you are then experiencing the nature of thought. What is the nature of thought? blip, blip, blip. That's the nature of thought. Endlessly coming and going, arising and disappearing. Doesn't matter. Good thought, bad thought, wonderful thought, terrible thought, they're all the same. Right? It's like weather. How's weather? Right? Some day sunny, clear, some day rainy. I mean, are you going to get bent out of shape about the weather? What? Why not?
Weather.
It's just the weather, and it's always changing, right? Yeah. So your job is what? If it's raining, you get your umbrella, right? When it stops raining, you take your umbrella down. That's all. When it's hot, you wear your cool clothes. When it's cold, you wear your warm clothes. I mean, isn't that all there is? There's no drama in that, is there? No. So the mind is just like that. Have you noticed? Some days it's like this, some days it's like that. Any other questions? Think about your life. Anything not clear? Everybody prepared to live an enlightened life. If you're not, keep asking questions. We may not meet again. Yes, Bill.
Continuing with the flower example, in my growth, it seems that at first awareness, and I'll use the label flower, is kind of a liberating thing. And so when you jump to the language, describe, classify, that you actually depart from that direct experience.
Depart.
Pardon?
Depart from that direct experience, yeah.
Well, having said that, the question I have is, if you still wanted to, it's hard to communicate that I have an understanding of flowerness without resorting to the language part. Now, I can feel a certain contentment and satisfaction in the direct experience of the flower, but it seems that as humans, we sometimes want to communicate, hey, don't you see this beautiful flower that I'm looking at?
Yeah, good. So let me just deal with this, okay? Right, so your question is, first of all, you say, yes, you understand that there's direct experience. And in the Zen and the Dzogchen tradition, the direct experience is what it's about. But there also is language. And don't we use language, which is often can go from just, you know, labeling, naming, to onward and upward of perceptions and compartmentalization and endlessly classifying, and right, and depending on what your work is or whatever, it can become more and more embroidered. Again, so your question is, isn't that useful? Yes, of course it is. Right. But again, the difference is, you may have a toolbox at home. Right? And you may find those tools and they're very useful for doing certain kinds of work. But you don't carry your toolbox, you know what I'm saying, with you all the time. You don't sleep with it. You don't, no matter where you go, you know, you use them. Right? Thoughts are, you know, like logic and rationality. I mean, these are tools to be used. They are aspects of our mind. They are something unique to human beings. And it can be quite wonderful if we understand what they are, right? Which is also to understand, that they're just labels. They're just, you know, they have no reality. This is reality. So yes, for me to say to Bill, hey Bill, come here, I want to show you this beautiful flower. Right? Yeah, that's, see, but that's pointing you in the direction of an experience. Right? But if I just, you know, if the flower's right here and I'm just going, hey, Bill, I want to tell you about this really beautiful flower. I really think you'd like it. And we start talking about the flower and I never go, you know, like, here it is. Experience it for yourself. So what happens a lot in the world of language, it's just language. It's just thoughts. And it's never taking us into experience. Now, again, it doesn't mean we don't have relationships and conversations. You know, I mean, that's... But it's also an understanding, you know, that it's not the same as real experience. So that's why, you know, a good storyteller is kind of giving us a feel, right, for the experience. Right? Again, reading about what? Reading about, you know, what it's like to be on the moon, right? What it's like to be in outer space, you know, can give us some kind of vicarious, right? But it's not the same as being there. Then that's a real experience of being on the moon. And there are words are just words. The word flower, I mean, which would you rather have? Beautiful flower or this? I mean, which would you rather look at all day? Right? A piece of paper that said beautiful red flower or this? But many people are satisfied with this these days. Living in a world of words and images and representations rather than the world of direct experience. You know, that again, why fundamentally in the practice of mindfulness, we're learning how to what? To be present to reality, right? To when we sit, to be present to the experience of sitting, when we walk, to be present to the experience of walking, when we're drinking, to be present to the experience of drinking, tasting, looking, right? It's kind of learning how to have a direct experience in life, which means to be alive, rather than an experience of thinking. Is that clear? Yes.
It's just interesting as you have that discussion, I notice in my mind, if I look at the blue conca on the wall, that there's a tendency when I just label it to say, oh, that's a conca, then it's like I close off the freshness of seeing it. Mm-hmm. It's when that label is coming up for me, oftentimes with phenomenon in life, that I'm not really seeing it because it's almost like a check off, oh yeah, I know conga, or flower, I know flower. And it's really interesting when I sort of drop that and just look at it and see it. It's a very different experience.
Right. So in other words, what we say in this practice is that the capacity for direct experience for many people is now covered over by this layer of conceptualization that is almost like a, you know, sort of like that. You can't see out. It's we call it a window, right? But all you can see is the design in the window. You can't see out. Is that clear? So when you like you're saying, we go through life and we go, oh, there's Betsy and there's Marilyn, you know what I mean? We label everything so we don't see them. That is why we say we may live with people every day, and yet we don't really experience them because we don't see them for the first time every time. When you see everything for the first time every time, you're living in truth. But if you're always, and this includes seeing yourself. Yeah, so let it go. When you come in, even though the word tanka, then stop and just look, see it. Yes.
I entered a class called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. Mm-hmm. Her claim was that she could teach anybody, mm-hmm. anybody to draw. Mm-hmm. And the secret was, mm-hmm. if you said draw an eye, mm-hmm. the Fred, all of Fred's eyes would look the same. But if you looked at the eye, mm-hmm. that you could learn to draw the eye. Mm-hmm. You know, various individuals. It was really looking mm-hmm. instead of letting language
right. get... Yeah, sounds like she was using, talking about a book called Drawing with the Right Side of the Brain.
Exactly.
And right, and it's sort of, again, it was teaching the people who are learning how to draw to get out of their thoughts about objects or what they were drawing and just to really just see it. Without any framework, intellectual, yeah. And that's, again, that's what Zen and these teachings of direct experiences are about. Again, it doesn't say thoughts are bad. It says stop thinking that your thoughts are real, that they're, you know. Now, by the way, within 2 or 3 weeks, we are getting new windows in here. And so we will be able to look out. And see what's outside. And that's what your meditation practice is about. You're learning to clear up the fog. But to clear up the fog, you first have to see that there is a fog there. Well, I think we've done it for today.